All right. As I said, my name's Toby, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Toby.
I really am feeling privileged to be able to hear the story of this gentleman tonight. When I first met him, or actually I saw him walk into the room, you can't help but notice him. There's something about him that grabs your attention. I don't know whether it's the demeanor in which he carries himself, that slow, steady walk, the handlebar mustache, or the ponytail. And I looked at him and I said, my gosh, he's kind of elven. Then I saw his arm, the tattoo. But what really caught my interest was when I first heard him speak. I heard him come straight from the book, and I heard him speak genuinely from the heart, a message of recovery and that he wanted to share with others. His outlook has always been to reach that helping hand of AA out in order to help his fellow alcoholic. With that, I would introduce to you tonight Mr. Bill O.
Say slow, steady walk.
Yeah. All right, big crowd.
Yeah.
Big crowd. Do we have anybody brand new in here tonight? First 30 days? Wow, old timers. Awesome. Anybody in their last 30 days want to tell us why you might be leaving? Okay, good. I'm an alcoholic and my name is Bill Ucci.
Oh, Bill.
And, now, I was thinking that I probably don't have to do this today because we could have brought out my CD and played that, or the other fact is that I told myself my story about six times today. It was different every time, and so that should count, but I realized that that's just the nerve. I get nervous. I've done this a lot of times, and yet I still get nervous. A sponsor of mine in the early days told me, if I'm getting nervous, it means I'm probably not going to lie. You know, I don't have a canned story. Some of the facts will be facts that you may have heard me talk about in other talks or in other meetings. And I never know what's coming out. Sometimes I learn a little bit about myself when I do this, which is kind of awesome when that happens. I like the readings that we started with, the foreword to the first edition. You know, it talks about 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And today, that has happened for me, but only for today. I remember very little before I was 7 years old, but I've heard lots of stories from my mother about. She knew before I was a year old that I was probably going to end up here or dead like my father. And, you know, a rebel from way back. She told me one story when I was just crawling. I couldn't walk yet. And I found some tweezers. And I walked over, or crawled over to the electrical socket and stuck the tweezers in. It threw me across the room. And she said, when I hit the wall, I just started laughing and started right back to get those tweezers again. You know, and that's just the way it was. You know, and she's telling me, no, 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 no. And there I was, going right for it again. I don't know a whole lot about my father other than I do know now that he's dead. He died from the disease of alcoholism. And he died at age 52, and today I'm a little older than that. So, you know, I've been given a gift here, a huge gift. Some of my earliest memories, first grade, not a whole lot of memories about the first grade. I was only six, but we had to get these vaccinations that left a mark on your arm, and I don't know if they do that anymore for you youngsters, but smallpox was it? I forgot. Anyway, my last name starts with O, so I'm right in the middle of the line. It's A to Z. And you know, part of this alcoholic, my thinking back then was, I don't even deserve to be here. I should be at the back of the line. And the other part of my head said, wait, man, I should be at the front of the line. You know, and that's just the way I think. And sometimes I still think like that today. I started drinking at the age of 7, shortly after my father left, blessed by some people who thought it would be fun at a 4th of July party to see some kids get tipsy. And you know, I remember getting there to this 4th of July party, and there were probably 150 people in this backyard. It's a pretty good-sized backyard. And I didn't know how to fit in, which I didn't know how to fit in anywhere previous to that. And I found myself back in the back corner of the yard, hanging out. And when I went to the house to go to the bathroom, somebody handed me a drink. They saved my life that day, because before that party was over, I was in the middle of it. I was having a great time. And I chased that. I chased that for a long time. I think I did puke that night on the way home, and that's, you know, but that didn't stymie the process whatsoever. You know, it's a little puke, big deal, you know. I'm going to feel like that again. And so I chased it. I started skipping school at 12, 13 years old, and started getting in some trouble about that time. Outside of the house, I was always in trouble inside the house. At the age of 12, my mother told me that this thing, and we hadn't seen my father in 5 years at that point, and we assumed him dead at that point. And she said, "You're going to die like your father if you keep this up." And I had no clue that the woman even knew that I had drank a second time. I knew she knew the first time. And needless to say, you know, I played innocent. What do you mean? What do you mean? I hadn't yet had a hangover. Hadn't puked again, you know, hadn't been in trouble yet, but somehow she knew. And, you know, since I've been sober, when she told me, she knew when I was real small, so you were different. And that's the way it was. I joined a lot of things along the way trying to find my spot. I remember I joined the Boy Scouts, and they taught me a lot about how to live outdoors. That came in handy later on in my life. We moved between 8th and 9th grade. When we got to this school in 9th grade, I said, "I'm going to play football." I weighed 115 pounds. Needless to say, I got my butt whipped a lot. And then the guy waited till the end of the season. One of the coaches was also the wrestling coach. He said, "Why would you like to compete with guys your own size?" And he got me to wrestle. And I wrestled through high school. And I got pretty good at it. But you know, that last summer that I was at home, I was 16, getting ready to be a senior in high school. And the feces hit the oscillator. I had my first stint in jail. Stole my stepfather's car. He thought it would be good to lock me up. It might teach me something. They weren't too happy when I brought it home with a bullet hole in it. So I spent 3 days in jail. And the thing was, is we lived in this little bitty town outside of Cincinnati, Ohio. There was 2 jail cells. There was a TV. They brought me food, and sometimes they would stay and play cards with me. It's like Andy Griffith. Let me tell you what, I was never, ever afraid of jail after that experience. I got in some trouble. I think it was the first day of school we skipped and got in some big trouble, a friend of mine and I. And it was all over the booze. And I quit school and got my mother to sign the papers to get in the military. And I remember telling her very clearly that they'll make a man out of me, which she thought was a good idea. And she signed the papers, and 3 days later, I was marching to the tune of a different drummer in San Antonio, Texas. I served the Air Force for just about 6 years, and, you know, right at the end, I got in some big trouble, and they put me out. In the beginning, I thought, boy, I could retire from this, you know. And my brother, who's a year younger than me, did retire with 30 years. And, you know, he's living on a nice pension, got him a good job because of his Air Force experience. And, you know, I got a little part-time job and a part-time business, you know. And that's okay today. What I have found since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous is none of that stuff really matters. I have had good, really good jobs and lived really high on the hog, four vehicles in the, you know, in the garage and in the driveway at a time, you know, living by myself. You know, I've had all the stuff, and the stuff doesn't keep you sober is what I found out. And then God finds ways to start taking it from you, you know, because I allowed that stuff to become my ego. And I'm talking with double-digit sobriety. The good news is I didn't have to drink over any of that. The good news is I learned every step of the way. And financially today, if you looked at my life financially, you'd say, man, that sucks. But it is what it is. And I know today that the power of God is going to keep me sober as long as I do the few simple things that it asked me to do in here. The biggest charge I get today is helping another drunk. Let me tell you a little story about how I got here. I already told you I didn't fit in anywhere. I didn't even fit in the military. Like I said, I got booted out of the military. I got back home to Cincinnati. Of course, my mother had some rules. You're gonna go find a job, you know. And now I've got 6 years in the military, and so I'm looking at, you know, really high-paying jobs. Vice president of accounting of this firm, because, you know, I'm pretty smart. Haven't been to any college, don't have a high school degree, but I'm pretty smart. So I'm looking at these jobs, put a little sport coat on and some dress pants and a little tie, and every day I'm going out and not having any luck, and I probably did that 3 or 4 weeks. And one day I came home and the newspaper's open on the kitchen table, and my mother says, well, you know, Bill, maybe you're being a little too lofty there. A little too lofty. And she had some jobs, sir. Janitor. Cleaning service needs help. Funny part about that was I had a job the next day with a cleaning service. I ended up owning that business because the owners moved and sold me the business. Of course, I had to tout my managerial experience from the Air Force. And so they made me like the crew chief, and then they sold me the business, which was pretty cool. Took me about 6 months to drink that whole thing away. And I mean, you know, I was pocketing a lot of money every month, and this was in the early 80s, close to 5 digits a month. And so I was doing it. But that didn't last long. I drank every bit of that away. And, you know, the last couple of accounts that I had left, I would drink until closing time at the bar and stagger my way to these accounts and go in and clean these businesses. Well, of course, the work was not up to par and lost those. My ego was huge at that time because I was a business owner. And I certainly couldn't go home and tell my mother I had failed yet again. So I went apartment shopping at the appliance store. You know, they have these great big cardboard boxes that they bring refrigerators to them in, and you put a couple of those together and you got like a two-bedroom apartment. It's all good. Besides that, bless you. Besides that, I knew that I was a master outdoorsman. And if you'd asked me, I would tell you, and I told lots of people this, I live out here because I want to. I'm doing what I want to do when I want to do it. Don't have a boss to answer to, the whole nine yards. And that's where I was at. You know, occasionally I wouldn't get back to my condo before it was too late to catch a bus. And, you know, I'd find a paper dumpster and climb in a dumpster and sleep there or wherever. It really didn't matter to me. I remember in November of that year, it started getting just a little bit chilly. So I cleaned myself up and called my mother and check to see if I could come back to the house because it was getting too cold. And she said, yeah, but you know, we got some rules. Same rules, get a job. She's still bringing up two little kids. My brother was 13 years younger than I am, and my sister is 10 years younger than I am. So they're still in school and pretty young. I think I was 23, so, you know, they were 13 and 10. And I remember being home, and at that point in my life, I was not looking to get a job at all. But I would get up, get dressed, and get out of the house, find a few bucks somehow, somewhere, and get to the bar and sit in the bar all day and stay drunk. And I got to tell you, even drunk, guilt and remorse can overwhelm a man, because it did me. I got up one cold December morning, there's about 8 inches of snow on the ground, and I had a friend contact me. He said, we're building houses down here in Florida, no end in sight. So I moved to Florida, and only took me 110 days to get here. I had a little stopover in a Crossbar hotel. That's jail, in case you didn't know that. And I was told never to come back to Atlanta. And I have been back to Atlanta, but I'll tell you about that later. I finally got to Florida. We're building houses. This guy's dad's a crew chief, and this guy's a carpenter. And I found a couple things out about myself. Number one, I'm not a carpenter. I also found out that I'm not a carpenter's helper. So I didn't work there very long. But while I was there, what a great job, because we got paid cash every day. And I'm living with this guy and his wife, and he got a little baby. And we get home, have some dinner, and I tell him I'm going out for a walk. I got a pocket full of money. And I don't know how I got home almost every night, no clue. Sometimes there were things on the coffee table. I slept on the couch. No idea where they came from. They obviously came from inside the house, somebody's house. I don't know whose house. So I figured that I probably was a blackout burglar. How I never got caught at that, God knows. One day I got a job in a gas station, and one day I came home from work at midnight, and my friend, his wife, and child had moved out lock, stock, and barrel, and locked the trailer, you know, so now I had nowhere to stay. And one of the things that I had in my pocket that had been on that coffee table was a set of keys, and so I looked at the keys, and there was a little address on there, and I found that car, and I stole it. I was heading back north. I was going to let my mother save me one more time, and I almost got there. The mistake I made was parking in a rest area with a stolen car. The next 5 years, I was on probation. I did some time at that point. I don't remember, 6, 8, 10 months in the local jail. But I was on a long probation, and while I was on probation, drunken disorderlies and disorderly conduct, I never got violated, which was a miracle, but I was in jail a lot. How many times? I don't know. Trying to think here. I remember right at the end of my 5-year probation. Now, I had been selling narcotics, and now I did some of it, but my deal is alcohol. I'm a boozer. The narcotics that I did do, I will tell you that I did them so I could drink more, if that gives you any clue as to what those were. And that was the only reason. I tried the downs. I don't like the downs because I can't drink on the downs. It puts me out. I want to drink, and I want to keep drinking, and I want to drink and drink some more, because I love everything about drinking. You know, the cute little umbrellas, the intellectual conversations. Anyway, I got to jail, and they gave me a 60-day stint about 6 months later. And I did that stint, and I was also sentenced to this program. It's called ADAP. It was alcohol, drug, something or other program, and it was a county-run program, and they also brought it into jail. And this guy that was in the cell with me was the first big book I ever saw. He was the big book, the first big book I ever saw. He was in jail doing an amends. He actually turned himself in. It was a minor offense. He did 30 days. That kind of amazed me. But he said they bring these meetings in on Tuesday nights. And ADAP, and I was like, oh, I got sentenced to that. He told me, you know, they bring coffee, and they didn't bring coffee except at breakfast. They bring cookies, and sometimes girls come in to carry this message. I'm all in, you know. So I go out here, and, you know, for the 6 or 8 weeks I was there, the coffee never showed up, the cookies never showed up, and there was never one woman showed up. So, but I went to them, and I'm thinking I'm knocking this requirement out while I'm locked up. I'm running the show again. I got out of jail, and the good news is this ADAP group that came in, somehow at least a small seed got planted, because I started thinking that maybe there was some slim possibility that maybe, I kind of doubted, that alcohol might have something to do with why I kept getting locked up. And so I thought, I'm going to try this not drinking thing. Now, I lived with a pretty little girl at the time, but, you know, my brain, as delusional as I was then, told me that it was all her fault that I went to jail. Now, she's not the one to violate the probation. She's not the one to sell the dope. You know, it was me, but it was her fault. Somehow or another, I don't know how I fathomed that today, but I did, because that's how I thought. It was always somebody else's fault. So I didn't go home. I slept on the beach. And the next morning, here was two of the cops from the jail, big cooler full of beer. They're fishing. And they're like, Bill, you're out of jail. Come on down here. Have a beer with us. We're fishing. Well, it's 8:30 in the morning. And I remembered I was trying not to drink. And so I said, well, maybe not. So probably the first beer I ever passed up that was offered. Whew. Profound stuff. But, you know, it's the end of April in Florida. We're on the beach. You start sweating. It's hot out. 9:30, 10 o'clock. Guess what? Maybe just one to cool off. I remember about half of that beer, and I was in a blackout. And this is how God works. He put me in a blackout. I woke up the next morning. The next thing I remember after pretty much popping that beer is waking up in Melbourne, 100 miles north of where we started, and on somebody's floor. And I thought about all that stuff on the coffee table. Like, man, I passed out in the middle of a freaking burglary. And I look around, and here's the two cops on the couch. I'm on the floor sleeping, and they're on the couch sleeping. And the first thing that came to my mind is something that a young man said at one of those ADAP meetings while I was in jail. He said, I know I'm alcoholic because when I pick up the first one, I never know how much I'm going to drink or where I'm going to end up. And that was like hitting me like a brick. I haven't had a drink from that day. And that was in April of 1988. But that is not the day I call my sobriety date, because I still didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was certainly scared to drink. I went home that day because it was now Saturday morning, and I knew this pretty little girl I lived with would be out to visit me. I better be home before visiting hours. So I went home and turned in the car that I rented in the blackout after driving us all back from Melbourne to Stewart. And I went home. And Sunday night I got two phone calls. One was from my boss that I had been working for less than a year. He said, I heard you got out of jail. You coming to work tomorrow? This is Sunday night. And I was just like, I still got a job? Awesome. Sure, I'll be there. And the second call I got was from the ADAP guy. I said, oh, no, 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 I did that. He just laughed. He said, no, it doesn't count in jail. So my show that I ran there just didn't work. I went to the ADAP meetings. I had four of them to do, and it was Wednesday to Wednesday to Wednesday. That's how I was staying sober, week at a time. And, you know, I got to the last meeting, and now I'm taking notes. I'm reading, listening intently. I never heard him say anything about going to AA. Never heard that. But I had all kinds of other stuff. Steps, God, which, of course, I had question marks about that. And, you know, other little notes that I wrote because I knew that I was already damned to go to hell. I got to the last meeting, and I'm looking at this guy, and I ask him, now what do? I don't have next Wednesday. And he said, well, Bill, you know, he laughed. He said, haven't you been listening to the thing we said? We've been telling you to go to AA. You did? You know, he hands me a meeting schedule, a little map of Fellowship Hall in downtown Stuart, Florida there. He said, you know where that's at? And I said, yeah, I know right where that's at. He said, great 7 o'clock meeting tomorrow. He opens the book, points the meeting out, and I see there's an 8:30 meeting, and I made a little note of that. So I get in the car, and it's about 6:45. I turn the corner, and there's a big crowd of people, and, I'm trying to act straight because I really don't want these people to know. And I'm driving around the block, and promptly at 7, nobody's out there. They've all gone in the room. So I parked the car about 6 blocks away so that, you know, I wouldn't be associated with AA kind of thing, you know. And now I'm walking around the block, and promptly at 8, of course, the big crowd's out there. They're all smoking. I'm trying to act straight, excuse me, as I walk through the crowd. And you know, that little, there's an 8:30 meeting, and the back door was cracked to let the smoke out. And I slipped in, there was one chair in the back corner, and I sat down in that back corner behind this lady with big hair. And, you know, I'm kind of using her hair to, you know, see, I didn't want anybody to see me there because they would know. I didn't put together that you people all had a problem with alcohol like I do. I didn't put that together. And the only person I recognized was a guy I drank with at this bar that smelled like stale pee and stale beer that you could smell 2 blocks away, and it wasn't far from where Fellowship Hall was. And he's chairing the meeting, and I'm thinking, damn, he's the only guy that can see me because he's facing. So I'm really working her hair, and the steps are on the wall behind him, and you know, I knew I was powerless over alcohol, so that I proved to myself with that last drunk. Now, I used to live outdoors, sometimes eat out of dumpsters, panhandle, give blood, whatever it took to get drunk. Today I live in a house, I got a job, I got a girlfriend, and I got a car. I don't think my life is very unmanageable. I told you I was going to work the steps for you, so I'm going to do that right now. So I pressed on. I'm in my first AA meeting. And then I saw this power greater than me, and I thought, well, okay, well, you people are way greater than me. I can't drink here, or you guys will whip my butt. And then I saw the word God in step 3. I was like, holy cow, you know, this ain't going to work for me. And, you know, but I saw the smiles, and I heard somebody somewhere in that meeting say this thing works no matter how bad a drunk you are. And I thought, well, okay. So I said the 3rd step prayer. I said, okay, dude, you got it. And then his inventory, yeah, I robbed this, stole that, you know, did that, screwed that one over, blah, 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 blah. Okay, I got my inventory. And now I'm thinking, well, this God's supposed to be all-powerful. So I get to step 5, and if I tell God myself, if he's all-powerful, I really don't have to tell nobody else. So it's all good. And so my defects of care, I'm thinking I can go without stealing. You know, I can go without whatever else I was in that little inventory. So it's all good. I thought I worked those steps so well that when I got home, I called my mother up to make amends. Now, this was a woman who was in Al-Anon before I was born. I'm 29 years old, and I'm calling her to make amends, so she'd been in Al-Anon quite some time. That woman thought that was the funniest thing she heard all day. She laughed and laughed and laughed. But about the time she was finally able to control herself, you know, I'm shrinking, you know. She's laughing at me. And first day of sobriety, she finally said, "Bill, if you never drink again, that will be amends enough for me." Powerful words that I will never, ever forget. Now, I spent a lot of time in those early days going to a lot of meetings. I go to a meeting before work, I go to work, I go back to the meeting, because, you know, in my head, it was still that damn girl's fault that I live with, so it was 5:30. Well, we're out here chit-chatting, 7's about to start, we might as well stay. So I'd go to the 7 o'clock, we chit-chat, the 8:30's about to start, I go to the 8:30, pretty soon I got 4 meetings a day going, and, you know, I'm starting to hear all those profound things, you know, like when somebody says in a meeting something, and it came out of the book, and you hear that kind of low, ooh, kind of thing. You know, I started learning those sayings, and I'd find them in the book, and I figured if I could say them, and people were, "Bill, you're doing great, you're doing great." And I thought I was doing great. And every time you saw me in an AA meeting, I had my big smile on, you know, but all I was doing was going to meetings. And inside that little knot of all that stuff I was carrying around that I didn't clean half of when I did the steps that first day, it was building and building and building. But I was making a lot of meetings. And there came a day when the pain was so great that I thought if this was what it's like to be sober, that I don't need to be here anymore. I was not going to drink, but I was certainly prepared to blow my head off. And I got my pistol out and I sat on the pool deck in my backyard. And I was ready to go. Gun was in the mouth. I said, "Dude, I'm coming to meet you now because this ain't working for me." And he intervened. Somebody walked up the side yard, and of course my ego couldn't let you see what I was getting ready to do. So I put the gun away. And the next day, you know, I couldn't get myself back up to the task later that night. The next day, the teacher appeared. And now I had read this book, I don't know how many times, and this is the book I got, I think, at my second AA meeting. And this guy opened the book with me, and we started at the beginning in downtown Stuart, Florida, on a picnic bench right by the river. And we went through this book, and he helped me to see. You see, I thought I was stuck on doing this inventory. Because every time I hear somebody with less time than me say my sponsor has me doing the 4-step, I would go home thinking he ain't passing me by, and I'd write that first name in 15 pages about what this son of a gun had done to me. And it wasn't worth it. I'm figuring, well, with all the people on my list, this will take forever. In the trash it would go. I found out there's clear-cut directions in here. I found out it wasn't a 4-step stopping me, and it wasn't a 3rd step stopping me. It was the 1st step. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I just couldn't see my life as being unmanageable. My job was getting better. I was making more money then, 2.5 years later, than I was when I started, or when I got out of jail. And, you know, had 2 cars in the driveway, and things were going well. When I finally got to see that I was banging my head against the same brick wall over and over and over again, even in sobriety, and finally understand what that meant, I was able to press on. And when we got to the 3rd step, when he figured I understood the 2nd step, this guy, now he's got long hair about halfway down his back, he's got a full beard, he gets on his knees. Now we're out in downtown Stuart, Florida. And he puts his hands out, and I'm like, "What are you doing down there?" He said, "You're going to get down here and pray with me. We're going to say this 3rd step prayer." And I said, "Well, I don't know the 3rd step prayer, you know, because I'm making excuses." And he pops a book open to the 3rd step prayer. He said, "Just read it." And I read this 3rd step prayer about as fast as I could read it. And I'm up, I'm looking around to see who might have seen all that. You know, I don't want people to think I'm weird or anything. And anyway, this guy didn't move. He's still on his knees. He's looking up at me. I'm thinking, "You look like a picture I've seen in a church, you know." And he says, "Well, Bill, now you know you can do it. Why don't we do it right this time?" And I'm like, "I got to do this again." He said, "You know, you can keep feeling like you're feeling, or you can change your life right here, right now." And I got on my knees, He said, just think of what you're reading. Think of what each word is as you read it. And somewhere in the middle of that prayer, every hair on my body stood up. When I finished that prayer and let go of this man's hand, I wasn't in a hurry to get up. I knew things were going to be different. And he set me down with a Big Chief notepad. And he pointed out that you don't write the first name and then what they did to you. You write your list. It says it in a book. Now, I read this book I don't know how many times. I never saw that. I had been in here, and they have the little picture, and every time we read this page with the picture of the four-step, they always read a cross. That's how I thought you worked it. That's not how you work it at all. The directions are right here. And so I made the list. He said, now, you see how long that list is? It was long. It was very long. Some of the people, I didn't remember their names. He said, keep that list right next to you, one at a time, and realize it's so long that you better only write one or two things about each one. Oh, not 15 pages? No. She said, look at the example. You know, 17 words is the biggest one in there. That's the biggest one I want to see on your paper. Okay. So I did that. I got done with that. He come up and he helped me to see, you know, where the self-esteem, the sex relations, and all those things were affected. And then it was my part. Now, there were some other things that were very obvious what my part was. And I wrote those down, but most of them were blank because it was their fault in that first column. That's where I was. And I told him, by the time we got through all three parts of this thing, we got to talking about it. And I said, well, he said, the very first one, well, what's your part? I said, well, didn't you hear what I said, what they did to me? So he started asking me some questions. This guy had a way to narrow down all my BS and all my delusion. And all of a sudden I realized I had lied. I had been selfish. I had been self-centered in almost all of them. I was like, are you kidding me? And it didn't take long, about four or five examples that I didn't have any part in, of course, and him asking a few questions, realizing that, guess what? I got these problems in every one of these. I started the ball rolling. And we got through that fifth step, and he said, now, it tells us right here, go home for an hour and think about what you've done. Did you miss anything? And I went home, and I got real quiet, and I put the book on the shelf right away because it says to take it down from the shelf after an hour, which is what I did. And then I called him up, and he said, the good news was I got to do the seven-step prayer inside his house, which was a good thing. So I went to his apartment, and we did the seven-step prayer. He said, now you got your list. Tomorrow you're making some amends. Which ones you want to make? You know, and I looked at the ones, and there were some that were going to be easy. There were some that were going to be pretty difficult. There were some that had a lot of money attached to them. There were some I'm thinking I'm never going to be able to do that. And anyway, he had me separate those out on the list. The easy ones, he said, you're going to get those done in the first week. Well, when I made the very first amends, the feeling I got, all of a sudden I wanted to do more because I love the feeling. That was so cool. And those ones that were maybes, man, I moved them right on in. Because all of a sudden, all those that stuff they talk about in the nine-step promises, I started to not be afraid of people. I started not to have I had a lot of money at the time, but I had financial insecurity because I wanted more. That was the nature of my thinking and my disease. More. So I had financial insecurity. I had a fear of it. I had a fear of a lot of things, as I have since found out. And, you know, these amends were awesome. I started doing the 10-step and thinking about my day every day. And I got a friend who says it like this. And he says, if I could do a better 10-step, I'd never have to do another 4-step. Now, what I believe, at least for this alcoholic, is when I'm working with somebody in the steps, I'm working them right alongside. When he's doing a 4-step, I'm doing a 4-step. When he's telling me about his 5th step, I'm throwing some of my stuff out there too. Because I found out during that fifth step that I did with this gentleman, you know, I had those last few pages. He ain't never seen this, ever. And, you know, he sensed my nervousness, and he started throwing some of his heavy-duty stuff out. And I'm like, you did that? I can break this one out. You know, you did that? I can break this one. And before I knew it, the last item was on the table, and I couldn't hide from you anymore. Here I am. It was this other human being, God and me, right there, just like the fifth step talks about. And I have to tell you that the book says often we will feel like we'll never drink. The drink problem is gone forever, or whatever the wording is. And I felt like that then. I still have some amends from that very first list, because some of these people are in Europe. Some of these people are in states in the West. But I remain willing to make amends to every one of them. It's all good. I spend a lot of time looking to grab newcomers up and work with them, take them right through this book just like I was taken through the book, because this book has a great explanation of what goes on in AA. And it tells you exactly how to do this thing. I got a pigeon in a room tonight who has done the third step prayer outdoors in public. And you know what? When he got up, he was charged up and he got to writing. And that's how this thing works. That's my experience, and I pass that on. I always take my guys through that third step prayer outside. Try it sometime. It is electric. It is electric. It's electric for me every time. And every one of them, it's been electric for. Now, they haven't all stayed sober because they let up on a spiritual program of action and rested on their laurels. I try not to do that. Sometimes I do. I'm not going to tell you I'm perfect every day, because I certainly am not anything close to that. What I found out is that when I carry the message to the next suffering drunk, when I work the steps with them, that is the treatment for alcoholism. It says so in the first paragraph, first sentence, I believe, working with others, that nothing will ensure my sobriety better than intensive work with another alcoholic. And that's how I try to live my life today, by these principles, to keep my side of the street clean. And when it's not, I better be willing to go make some amends, and promptly. Because when I hold on to stuff, I twist myself up and I start digging a ditch, and then I start going to, I go to the furniture store because I have to furnish my ditch that I dig. I don't like furnishing ditches anymore today, but I really do love being sober and helping others. Thanks for letting me share tonight.
So much, Bill.
That was great. Absolutely great.